Welcome to the End of Agriculture. I'm Sarah Mock.
And I'm Connie Bowen, and we're discussing the how might and the what if behind the end of foundational elements of agri-food systems.
All right, today we're talking about the end of ethanol. What is ethanol? I think that's a good place to start because not everyone really understands what it means when they get like E85 gas or fuel at the gas pump or what else kind of people mean when they hear politicians talk about whether or not they support ethanol, which is always a question in Iowa primaries. So ethanol is refined corn alcohol that's mixed with gasoline to make vehicle fuel. And it can be like blended at different levels, but the overwhelming amount of ethanol available like at gas pumps is mixed with gasoline to create the idea being a more efficient, less destructive gasoline product, basically thinning out gasoline to make it cheaper and less fossil fuel.
And I'll chime in too quickly and add kind of the two engine performance variables that are accounted for here, which is fuel density. So how much oomph do you get per unit fuel? Ethanol is lower energy density than is petroleum. And also, and this is a little bit controversial, but engine wear and tear is kind of the other variable there. So like arguably ethanol burns cleaner, but there's trade-offs there. Or there might be, depending on what study you're reading.
So before we can talk about the end of ethanol, we have to talk about how we got to ethanol right now, because it's not super intuitive to put corn into gas tanks and use it to power millions of cars on the road in America and around the world. So corn ethanol for fuel was born or a product of the 1970s, according to an Atlantic article I read. As a response to fuel shortages that then promptly went away. And honestly, like the ethanol industry kind of went nowhere for the next 30 years, just very little growth, very little need. And until 9/11, tensions in the Middle East were escalating and the U.S. had a significant dependence on foreign oil from the region. And that suddenly started to look like a weakness for U.S. lawmakers, U.S. economists, folks across the board, and with markets in the crapper, the idea of buying produce from family farmers to power America's energy, quote, unquote, energy independence, which was a really important key phrase in the 2000s, became extra mega patriotic and powerful. So Congress wrote the Renewable Fuels Standard, another very important term for ethanol, and put it in place, which ensured that tens of billions of gallons of ethanol would be produced and blended into gasoline every year by federal mandate. There was a mild, and for the environment, element too, but in the early 2000s, Al Gore's environmental messaging was not very widely resonant, and the supporting science around the good of ethanol was weak relative to other forces. It was certainly a factor that helped get more parties on board for the RFS, but that ethanol is better than gasoline was not kind of the main purpose. The RFS is not a program that's about saving the environment. It's a program about helping farmers and creating energy independence. So now it's 2020 and we're 15 years into the RFS and its mandatory funding mechanism will come into question in 2022, which means its future right now is pretty uncertain.
Okay, but wait, Sarah, I want to dig into this a little bit more. Why corn? Like, obviously, we've got a lot of corn in the U.S., and at some point, when you look at the beginning of ethanol and kind of in the 2000s, right, like, we already had a lot of corn, but why do we have so much corn?
Yeah. That is an incredibly complex question in a lot of ways, but it is in other ways very simple, which is basically because we've always had a lot of corn. Corn is a good crop in the United States. It was grown here. There were like land races here when colonizers first arrived. It was better suited to the soils here than wheat and other kind of grain crops that people brought with them. And we just had a lot of corn. Farmers got good at growing corn. Farmers liked growing corn. It made sense with the way our diets worked. And it just, I don't know, it's a legacy crop. It made sense and it never stopped making sense. And farmers, ever conservative farmers, like to grow things they know how to grow. And so it's really hard to switch crops, especially certainly to switch away from kind of your main crop or one of your most important crops, perhaps. So yeah, those are the obviously lots of other factors there. Lots of one, as productivity in corn skyrocketed in the early 1900s, you know, up to the 1950s and 60s and, you know, well into today, we had way too much corn. And so we started, you know, usually how economics works is when there's an oversupply, people make less of it. But instead, because of the way that a lot of different systems in U.S. food and agriculture work, we just found new demand for it instead. So we put corn into everything from, you know, refined sugar products to, you know, used it to make packing materials and types of plastic. And, you know, we just took that oversupply and we found markets for it rather than just cut back on growing corn. And the most successful ways that that strategy worked was with ethanol, because it, you know, 40% of the U.S. corn crop goes to ethanol right now. And yeah, that's a great way to move a lot of corn and to let to keep a lot of farmers growing a crop that they like, that they're familiar with, that we've poured billions of dollars in genetics research into, perfecting that, like all our equipment, the way that our counties look. You know, all of those things have been kind of driven and defined by corn.
Fair enough. I think we could get really in the weeds and we could probably talk everyone's ear off a little bit more, pun intended, about the history of corn, because actually when you dig into it, one of the things that I think is really important in this conversation is corn versus other, other crops for biofuel, so like switchgrass, sorghum, whatnot. It's really important. The surplus of corn and how we got there is really important, and the ease with which we can produce it, I suppose. Yeah, it's just a really important part of this conversation that, like, the geek in me, and I love new crops, right? Understanding why corn won over other crops is, I think, important to understanding how we maybe shift things a little bit if we do. And so with that, let's fully shift things. What would happen if what does the end, how could we get to the end of ethanol?
Yeah, so I think this is actually not a hard future to imagine, because of the fact that the RFS, the renewable fuel standard as a policy, is going to come into question in the next 2 years. The oil and gas industry is incredibly powerful and adept at lobbying, and really has outmaneuvered the ethanol industry dramatically in terms of getting, you know, political support and, you know, its needs met on Capitol Hill. And if the RFS goes, there's like basically no hope for ethanol, because what the RFS does is it forces oil and gas producers to blend ethanol with gasoline. To your kind of sciencey point, without the blend, there's no use for ethanol as a fuel. So there is, so like, if you can't force blenders, if you can't force oil and gas producers to use ethanol, then there's no market for ethanol. And so, like, if the policy goes away, that's kind of the end. And, you know, I think with the global pandemic happening right now, the Trump administration is thinking about waiving RFS requirements totally for this year, because obviously travel has plummeted to zero and oil and gas companies are really suffering. All opinions and thoughts and feelings about oil and gas, the idea of the oil and gas industry suffering aside, you know, those voices are being heard in Washington. And the ethanol industry is already kind of mortally wounded at the moment. There's been this big waiver issue in Washington for the last 2 years or 3 years under the Trump administration, where quote unquote small refinery waivers, small refiners can appeal to the EPA and say, the EPA is in charge of the renewable fuel standard, and say, we're too small. The economic harm of having to blend ethanol into our fuel, because they have to buy the ethanol, that burden of having to do that is too big. So we need to have our gallons, our requirement waived, to basically like stay afloat, is their argument. The number of waivers requested has skyrocketed in the last 3 years, and the number of waivers approved has also skyrocketed. The Trump administration has told all kinds of, again, quote unquote, small refiners that they can have exemptions, even when, you know, they're refiners that are part of the ExxonMobil chain of refineries, which is like a global multinational corporation that certainly is probably not like in, or wasn't before COVID, in the kind of dire economic strains that would require them to not be able to afford ethanol to blend and meet their requirements. So basically, the collision course of ethanol and the oil and gas industry, ethanol advocates and the oil and gas industry, is they've been colliding for 2 or 3 years, and ethanol has been losing. So the fact that ethanol advocates would have to make a new push in 2022 to make sure that blending requirements at the very least stay the same, if not increase, and blenders would be required to blend even more ethanol into fuel, seems like there's almost no way that they would get that, meet that goal.
Okay, but so when you're talking about a lot of the pain of the oil and gas industry, which is sure, but also, what about the pain of, like, you know, the farm industry? And we're looking at like $3 or sub $3 corn right now. So I guess, how big of a role do growers have to take here before either they, you know, what, I guess, to what extent can that be factored into policy? And also, to what extent can that be factored into grower decision making and maybe saying, huh, I could be doing something else? Or I guess the point kind of, the could the supply end ever become part of the question, right?
Yeah. So breaking that into two questions, both super interesting. One, on the supply side, or on the policy side, would that ever be taken into account on the policy side? One, different administrations would certainly absolutely look at that very differently. The current administration would say, it's cheaper to just pay farmers cash, they basically have said that for 2 years, giving out billions of dollars, than to force markets to work in a certain way, i.e. requiring oil and gas producers to blend ethanol, thus creating a market for farmers. It's easier to just like skip that whole middle part and just like send money to farmers and don't make oil and gas blend ethanol. That's basically their strategy right now. Obviously, farmers have and ethanol advocates have been really upset about that and have advocated against that. It hasn't been effective. On the grower side, yeah, I mean, should farmers look at falling oil and gas prices and say, or falling ethanol prices and corn prices and say, yikes, maybe I should plant less corn? Absolutely. The problem is, despite the fact that 40% of corn goes into ethanol, there's also another huge market out there that's not going away, which is livestock. That's corn's biggest, corn and soybeans' biggest kind of market, even bigger than ethanol, is animal feed. So if they can keep that market, these decisions aren't made by like the CEO of farmers about like what makes sense in the long term. It's made by each individual farmer. So if you're an individual farmer and you feel like, well, I have a good relationship with the local feedlot, so why would I ever switch out of corn? It's such an individual decision made at the individual level that it's hard to say that there could be it. I don't know. It's hard to predict big trends, but I think the other part of that is prices are incredibly low right now. They've been incredibly low for like 6 years, and it just really hasn't made that much of a difference. One, farmers own equipment to plant, chemically treat, and harvest corn that you can't just sell easily. They, you know, their fields, their operation, everything, all the skills they've built over their career are built around how to grow high yielding highly productive corn. Not a lot of farmers have skills or expertise in other crops. I mean, obviously, a lot of farmers have skills in like soybeans as part of a corn and soy rotation, or, you know, lentils or potentially like one other crop. But it's really hard to switch a significant amount of acres over to a completely other crop just because like, oh, corn prices are bad this year. Great. I'll grow tomatoes. That's essentially impossible. If a lot of farmers would think of it that way. So the thing is, even with corn prices low and even with ethanol markets in question, I don't think you're going to see a significant move. I think it would be tough to predict a significant move out of corn because at the end of the day, one, corn is heavily subsidized. And so it's safer than a lot of other risky kind of like new fangled crops. And it just is, you know, it's something that farmers have been growing all their lives and have a confidence in. They feel good about their ability to grow it. Whereas, you know, it takes you years and years to even have, you know, 3 or 5 chances to grow some other crop. And the idea of, you know, suffering through 5 years of not even bad prices potentially on another crop, but just being bad at growing it is really hard, especially for, I think, older guys and who are just trying to, you know, get through to retirement or get through to transitioning their farm to someone else. There certainly should be a response on the supply side. The evidence in agriculture for like the last century is that there tends to not be one.
Yeah, right. We could go on for a while about the psychology of changing crops. I guess in short though, here what we've got essentially is for as relates to ethanol is the supply side is absolutely sticking around kind of no matter what. And so the way that we might get to the end, which I'll have you describe here in a minute, but the way that we'll get to the end is actually only going to happen on the demand side. And so that's necessarily going to be kind of painful, unfortunately. It's not like there's no other way to look at that.
Totally. And the last other thing, I mean, I think the end of the RFS as a policy and how detrimental that would be for ethanol is one part of the situation of what could bring about the end of ethanol. But I think the other half of that, which is a little bit further off, but I think could really realistically be in the next decade, is the rise of electric vehicles. Because the reality is that people are looking to electric. That's kind of the next big trend in
hydrogen. Let's not forget hydrogen fuel cell.
And hydrogen. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I recently heard someone talk about sugar, using sugar in batteries. Like there's so many other ways to power vehicles, which is the only thing that.
Well, hey, that's another use for your corn, by the way.
True, true. So true. But yeah, there's so many other ways to power a vehicle. Ethanol does not anymore have like a claim to being environmentally kind of out in front. It's just, and it encourages kind of a lot to environmental people. It encourages monocultures. It encourages, the declines of rural communities, like, or it could be connected to them. There's just so many things about ethanol that don't make it that much better than oil and gas that it just like doesn't really stand a chance against, you know, something that's has a much better argument in those circles, and electric cars certainly do. And I think that there's a chance that they could really be cheaper and better and quieter and solve so many problems. And trying to convince oil and gas companies to blend ethanol is like a tiny, tiny problem compared to the mammoth pending doom of electric vehicles and the fact that like ethanol is just will not compete at all with that.
Right. Well, when you get into the environmental question though, with ethanol, and actually with all biofuels, and actually even with some of these even with electric cars, right? When you actually start to look at the full life cycle assessment and you start to actually look into the components that go into these things, and you start to look at the components that go into manufacturing ethanol, but I mean, this is true for everything. I'm not trying to pick on ethanol here. This is the same situation in many ways as you've got with like plant-based meat, right? When you actually look at the manufacturing process behind these like quote-unquote better alternatives, usually almost always on the early days end of that, the manufacturing process, and I'll just use that to be a like loose umbrella term, but that manufacturing process is more environmentally intensive. And theoretically, technology increases efficiency and you can get to a point where it's less environmentally intensive. And one of the things that I don't know enough about, but am trying to learn more about is just that kind of environmental question mark as relates to biofuels more generally. And to me, ethanol fits into, I look at it more from an input output, energy derived from kind of engineer-y look at that. But anyway, without getting too much more into the weeds, let's quickly describe the end. What does it look like?
Yeah, I'm going to go kind of pie in the sky because I think that there's an end of ethanol that looks very similar to kind of the reality we're living in right now. But I am, as an excited ag futurist, because 40% of the U.S. corn crop goes to ethanol currently, corn would need to find another huge market for millions, if not billions, of bushels of corn every year. And if it can't do that, which it seems unlikely right now that there's just because literally, I really can't emphasize this enough, everything we eat has corn in it. And everything we use, so many consumer products contain corn. It's corn has made its way into seemingly everything it possibly can already. So the idea that there's somewhere in the economy that can absorb an insane amount of additional corn is hard. It's hard for me to believe that something's out there. So if there is no alternative market for corn as ethanol goes away, corn acres will have to get converted to something else. Bad news for farmers is there's not a lot of other crops that are as efficient cost-wise for farmers. One, because they've made a lot of kind of investments already to their operations that are good investments for corn and maybe not as good of investments for a lot of other crops. And I think, we've kind of talked about already, farmers are more comfortable with corn. They have experience. It's hard to grow something that you're not, that you're not experienced with. The corn market is really well developed and efficient, and other markets are just not as developed. I mean, you, Connie, have experience seeing kind of what the hemp market looks like right now. Like, the costs of an underdeveloped or undeveloped market are high.
Right. I restrained myself from interrupting and messing up audio there, but when you think about what can you actually plug in kind of as an alternative to corn, I think one thing that's interesting in the like diversify farming kind of movement is oftentimes there's not this consideration for all of this infrastructure that you've already invested in. And these like what you, the farm practices that you're used to using. And so hemp is, it's funny because like hemp was super hot and I feel like it's like kind of maybe lost a little bit of its like sparkle. But maybe that's just because we're distracted by other stuff right now. But anyway, I think it's interesting because when you look at hemp, it kind of has two directions that it's going in. And that like money is being fueled for it. And one is on the like CBD cannabinoid extract, even kind of the THC component, but really this kind of like nutraceutical health, like high end, high value extract thing where you only need to plant, a couple of acres. We're not talking about a real, this is not a corn replacement. But what's interesting about hemp, actually, is that it can be bred to be more like a corn replacement. And then you have a similar thing where you've got a crop that has a bunch of different components that can go into a bunch of different value streams. And if you can breed it such that you can plug and play or slightly modify your existing equipment, then in theory, all of these things, I mean, and I am bullish on this. I actually think that this can happen. But the problem is you have to have kind of the downstream market processing. Hemp has to be allowed in animal feed. It's not right now. But things, I'm not aware of a lot of other crops like hemp right now that are so clear, at least it's so clear to me how this can kind of plug in for corn relatively easily. I get really excited about a lot of new crops. But this one, from a grower standpoint, I think might be able to be easily substituted or relatively easily substituted. And that's why it's kind of exciting, I think.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, don't get me wrong. I am tired of the hemp story. There's mostly just because ag media in particular has told basically like exactly two hemp stories, which is like hemp is the future of agriculture. And also like, look at all these people who got burned by
hemp.
Oh
my God. Yeah. It's been so bad. People have gotten, I mean, the problem is there's this downstream processing and like, it's just no one knows what the heck they're doing. And there's not actually an input industry that's reliable yet. I could go on for a couple days here.
Yep. But I will say the upside to hemp as a potential replacement for corn is that it's already, whatever replaces corn, whether it's a mix of crops or it's one crop, will have to have a ton of policy support because corn already does. So to even be competitive with corn, you will have to already qualify for crop insurance through federal programs. You'll have to already, you know, be regulated by USDA in like some specific ways that allow, you know, extra protections for farmers and especially in times like right now, the last couple of years where like trade impacts, you know, severe weather impacts, those kind of things. And hemp got in the door to do that. You know, Mitch McConnell's from Kentucky and people in Kentucky wanted hemp and Mitch McConnell got it done. And hemp is got to be one of the fastest crops to get into kind of federal crop insurance programs. And despite the fact that there's still so many question marks and unanswered questions about hemp, I think it does have like a real, it could take up a lot of the acres of a potential, you know, significant shift away from corn, especially because there's also a potential to use combines that you use for corn to harvest hemp and use, you know, planters and some of this other equipment that farmers already have and just shift it without having to buy a bunch of new stuff to planting and harvesting hemp. Probably for fiber.
Yeah, right. Exactly. For fiber. There's a million different value streams and, you know, Google hemp, there's too many resources, right? But theoretically, the end of ethanol opens up the door or maybe lowers the barrier is the way I look at it, lowers the barrier of entry to something like hemp. And I frankly don't see anything else really like hemp right now that seems like it can compete. And like, let's be real, compete with corn doesn't mean like no more corn. It just means maybe like 1% of acreage, like, you know, like a little bit would be pretty big change here. The one other thing, though, that I think is interesting within the context of kind of the end of ethanol is farm size and impact that eliminating ethanol might have on farm size. Sarah, comment on that a little bit.
So I think this has a lot to do with that potential crop that could replace corn, because corn, along with soybeans, is the crop that empowered farmers to get big or get out. And nothing has driven, like, if farming corn and soybeans required more labor, if it required, you know, more machines that have to be operated by like multiple people. Basically, if any other crop that would replace corn or soybeans or that rotation pair came online, it would almost by necessity, I would think, lower farm sizes. Because the reason why a guy, you know, a 60-year-old can farm 2,000 acres on nights and weekends is because you can do when corn and soybeans don't require a lot of labor. And almost any other crop would require more labor, especially if people are, you know, if the answer to less corn is more of a mix of crops. So I think anything that puts pressure on corn and soybeans as like corn and soybeans being king of U.S. agriculture, I think creates more opportunity for, you know, if you're trying to do 2,000 acres of, you know, a mix of fruit and vegetable crops or having some annual crops or, you know, to your point about switchgrass or like cover more, just more in rotation, I think, or livestock, introducing livestock, every increase in complexity on the farm requires more brain power, more physical, like muscle power, and is more likely to require more people. And I think that just over time, because there will be limitations on how many people you can attract, it encourages you to use fewer acres. It's worth noting the other kind of clearer way maybe to get to that point is, you know, in the Midwest, you can, a guy can farm 2,000 acres on nights and weekends. In California, when you're growing lettuce, 300 acres of a lettuce farm is huge.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, right. That's the general push to specialty crops, really, but yeah, specialty crops. Just means that it gets more complicated. I mean, it's interesting to think about, like, what does that look like when you, so you've got what is a giant farm today who wants to get maybe portion a fraction of their land into kind of, you know, their forward thinking. They want to put a tiny part of their row crop acreage into something a little bit different. And you start to think like, okay, that probably for them means investing in staff. And you know, we're not going to get into robotics and automation here because we don't have the time. But, you know, it basically means they're making an investment in kind of a different sub team. And, what does that look like 10, 20, 50 years from now when you've got these like giant kind of land holdings essentially with like a bunch of maybe almost diversified operations on them? That could be cool.
I mean, I will say just quick final note on that. I could also totally see, I mean, I believe that more diversity on the landscape is good, that smaller farms are probably good in the long term, that farms should have more people on them. But pretty much every policy in agriculture so far and in most things that have happened in the last 80 years have actually made farms bigger and had less people on them. So like the chances that the end of corn actually means bigger operations because it in the meantime, it just, a lot of people retire and their big neighbors buy up their land and get even bigger, or because old guys don't want to learn a new crop, or that people get forced out of business trying to grow corn anyways because that's all they know how to grow. And then kind of the same thing happens. Like, it's just as like me as an optimist says the end of corn could mean smaller farm sizes. Me as a realist says it's just as likely that it increases farm sizes.
Yeah, right. Well, and I mean, that gets it, like, the other component of that is as farms get bigger, food gets cheaper, generally. Well, as there are fewer people on farms, food gets cheaper, I'll say. Or yeah. Fewer, or we pay them less, which is, that's another episode, folks. But I am very interested in the other kind of biofuel, advanced biofuel. My suspicion is, again, and this is where I get into, I don't know enough here, but I just feel like there hasn't been quite enough concentrated investment on bringing some of that to scale. And some of that might be because there's a better alternative, you know, opportunity cost of investment. I think when you look at improving the efficiency of creating biofuels, there is so much room for improvement there. And I think it can be done from what I can tell. So I'm interested to see how that plays with kind of like corn politics. But I just have to imagine, and I hope that, I think hemp does actually become a little bit of a disruptor here as soon as it's allowed in animal feed and as soon as you get enough high-end hemp genetics, which we're starting to get, but it's early days. I think that what's interesting is like, does ethanol have to stand alone or does ethanol just become another biofuel?
The one other thing I would add is I think the optics of ethanol were never that great, and they're getting worse all the time. I think part of that's misconception and like clever marketing by the oil and gas industry. And I think some of it was just like the fact that ethanol is a little bit half-baked as an idea already. And it's that, like, you know, one, as someone who hails from the state of Wyoming, you know, which is an energy state, and our lawmakers are very partial to energy interests. You know, I grew up believing that ethanol is a worse fuel, that it damages engines. And that is, I think, in a lot of people, like, just oil and gas industry propaganda. I don't know how good the science is. I've kind of heard things on both sides of that argument, and just do not know enough about petroleum engineering to get into how that works. But it's out there, and people believe that that's true, that ethanol is not as high a quality as regular gasoline. And so I think that that's a visibility marketing kind of problem. I think the fact that people will always say, why are you putting food into gas tanks? You know, again, not true. Corn is not edible by humans generally. The kind of corn that goes into ethanol is not used for human consumption ever. So that's not truly a good, you know, maybe critique, though that same land could be used to grow food. And that's just like a bad look. And then I think on the other side, there's a question of, is ethanol, you know, ethanol used to distract from all of its detractors by saying, listen, the future is green and ethanol is green, and so you can't question the future. And the reality is there, we've like, it was funny. I've had this conversation with people on Twitter where they're like, where's all the green people helping defend ethanol now? And it's like, no, the environmental kind of groups decided like a decade ago that ethanol is not green. It's like the way that you have to grow corn is not very sustainable, and to produce the quantities that are needed for ethanol. And it's like, it just all the promises of burning a renewable fuel aren't there when the renewable fuel is a crop that uses fossil fuel to grow.
Right. Yeah.
So I think overcoming those optics issues are just like, would be really hard in and of themselves, let alone doing it in the face of a $1 billion global industry coming to eat your lunch, which oil and gas is. And then like I said, the looming like true threat of electric vehicles being just around the corner, and like, you know, making the oil and gas industry look like a butterfly landing on your shoulder because like a hurricane's coming and is going to just destroy everything that you ever thought you knew about everything.
It's so funny because I have like I always got exactly the opposite messaging. I'm just feeling the need to add that there with like, my family has a corn soy farm in Iowa and my dad's an organic chemist. And so like, I had the exact opposite kind of conversation at the gas pump, which is that like, no, don't be like these, as long as you're using the right blend for your motor, then it's, you know, you're operating within the right, it obviously depends what kind of motor you have, but like all of the, because I had heard the oil and gas or the that ethanol is bad somehow for my car. I got exactly the opposite rhetoric, which is just kind of funny.
It's a merchants of doubt thing, right? It's just like, it doesn't really matter if it's true, which I'm sure it's not. But it just matters that it's out there and that some people believe that, and that some people, you know, are standing at the gas pump and would choose E85, but are like, ooh, I don't really remember what I learned about this and I don't want to risk it, so I just won't pick it.
Yeah, well, and this is why the marketing of some of these super complicated products is just like, how do you even convey that to a consumer? And like, what? Anyway, we could get in the weeds there, but basically, there might be an opportunity, I think, if I'm hearing you correctly, and I think this is true, but there might be more of an opportunity and kind of a rebrand through like next gen biofuels, I guess I'll describe them as.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. But okay, let's tie this up a little bit. What do you think's actually going to happen, Sarah? Like, what, like, we have had this like fun, we've played with a bunch of different kind of angles of this end of ethanol. Let's get a reality check in here.
Ethanol is a hugely strong lobby, and as long as Iowa holds the first primary, it will have outsized political importance in U.S. agricultural policy. Also, oil and gas industries are insanely powerful globally, and so even if the U.S. makes a significant move to electric, that doesn't mean that the other 7 billion people on Earth will. Also, cellulosic biofuels are on the horizon. Few of the advanced biofuels have made it to any significant scale yet, but if the science gets here soon enough to be turning agricultural waste products into clean fuel, there's really potential to slow the move away from fossil fuels and give the RFS and the idea of renewable fuels a second wind. So I think there's potential, but I would give the likelihood of ethanol as an industry reaching the year 2030, 3 out of 10 odds.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The End of Agriculture.